Well, last week we finished the first half of 2 Samuel chapter 13 that reports this horrific incident of David's firstborn son, Amnon, raping his half-sister Tamar in this out-of-control act of sexual lust. Now, I'm not going to review the gory details, but I do want to remind you of the surrounding circumstances and the intrigue that's involved. See, the author of the book of Samuel makes a point that Tamar was, at least in Amnon's eyes, overwhelmingly beautiful. And however, as much as Amnon's lust was the catalyst for the crime, in the background, there was this playing out of political and family jealousies. Now, much of what went on was about the struggle for power, for position within King David's royal family. Now, preparing this lesson turned out to be kind of a soul-searching exercise, so we're not going to make too much progress tonight. There's a lot of principles that just jump off the pages of this chapter, and they have so much bearing in our time that to go by them without making the connection would be to make our study not much more than a history lesson. Now, Amnon, as David's firstborn, was heir apparent to the throne. This hierarchy was understood by the people of Israel, by the extended royal family, by David himself. However, Absalom, another son of David, who was Amnon's half-brother, they had different mothers, also had designs for the throne, and he had spent years building up a following of loyal supporters, or in some cases just of insiders who were kind of placing their bets on Absalom somehow outmaneuvering Amnon and becoming king. And when Amnon violently raped Absalom's sister Tamar, Absalom and Tamar had the same mother and father, they were full brother and sister, and then her attacker instantly rejected her and threw her out of his bedchambers, there was a clear message behind this. And the message was that Amnon reaffirmed his position as the unquestioned crown prince. That as David's favorite and his firstborn son, he was untouchable. And that Absalom's side of the family, although influential, was going to wind up being subservient to him. In that era, to have sexual relations, especially if it was forced with a rival's wife or his concubine, or in this case, sister, that was a customary and unmistakable sign of domination and control. But there was another side to the story as well. Absalom was a clever and coldly calculating man. Amnon's assault upon his half-sister Tamar, which of course was ruinous for her, provided an opportunity for her full brother, Absalom, to use to his benefit what was otherwise a family disaster and really a setback, and has been the motto of ruthless political leaders and political hopefuls since time immemorial: you don't ever let a good crisis go to waste. All it would take is some determination and some patience on Avishalom's part, and his fondest aspirations just might become within reach. So let's pick up on this story at verse 19. 2 Samuel chapter 13, verse 19. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 347. Starting at verse 19, we're going to go to the end. Tamar put ashes on her head, tore her long-sleeved robe that she was wearing, laid her hand on her head, and went off, crying aloud as she went. And Abishalom, her brother, said to her, Has Amnon your brother been with you? But now, my sister, keep quiet. He's your brother. Don't take the matter to heart. But Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. And when King David heard about all these things, he became very angry. As for Absalom, he refused to say a word to Amnon, either good or bad, because Absalom hated Amnon for having raped his sister Tamar. Well, 2 years later, when Absalom had sheep shears in Baal Hatzor near Ephraim, Absalom invited all of the king's sons. And Absalom went to the king, and he said, "Your servant has sheep shears. Please, let the king and his servants come along with your servant." And the king replied to Absalom, "No, my son, let's not all go. We don't want to be a burden to you." But Absalom pressed him. He still wouldn't go. However, he gave him his blessing. And then Absalom said, "If you won't go, then please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom kept pressing him. So he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Absalom ordered his servants, "Pay close attention. When Amnon is in high spirits from drinking wine, and I say to you, kill Amnon, then strike him down. Now, don't be afraid. I'm the one ordering you to do it. But take courage. Be bold." Absalom's servants did to Amnon as Absalom had ordered. And at this, all the king's sons jumped up, mounted their mules, and fled. And while they were on their way, the news came to David that Absalom had killed all the king's sons, and not one of them was left alive. And the king got up and tore his clothes and lay on the ground, while all his servants stood by with their clothes torn too. But then Yonadav, the son of Shema, David's brother, spoke up. And he said, "My lord shouldn't think they've killed all the young men, the king's sons. Only Amnon is dead, for Absalom has meant to do this ever since the day he raped his sister Tamar. So my lord king shouldn't take it as seriously as if all the king's sons are dead. Only Amnon is dead." However, Absalom took flight. The young man, keeping watch, looked up and saw many people coming along the road behind him on the hillside. Yonadav said to the king, "Here, the king's sons have come. It's just as your servant said." And the moment he finished speaking, the king's sons came, and they cried out and they wept. And the king too, with all his servants, cried out in great pain. Absalom fled. He went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled, went to Geshur, and stayed there for 3 years. But as King David became reconciled to the death of his son Amnon, he increasingly filled with longing to see Absalom. I want to stress that over and over again, the words brother and sister are used in these passages to describe Absalom and Tamar's relationship. I do that because of the questionable teaching by some rabbis and sages that at times has even spilled over into modern Christian scholarship, that the two weren't really brother and sister at all. And this is because if they're not related, it means there wasn't really any incest in David's family. And there could have even been a good argument that what occurred between Amnon and Tamar wasn't so much rape as simply an overzealous seduction by a young, virile man of a somewhat reluctant young female, kind of mirroring the David and Bathsheba affair. Now, the goal of this line of reasoning is, of course, to read a predisposed doctrine of Judaism back into the story, with that predisposed doctrine being that David was innocent, if not utterly sinless, throughout his lifetime. And therefore, the reason that David didn't take any action whatsoever against Amnon after he heard what happened was the proper response, because nothing terribly wrong had occurred anyway. Now, I'm sure that this idea of reading a predisposed doctrine back into a biblical story is something that you recognize probably ought not to be done, because it either distorts or misapplies God's commandments and his principles. It takes God's message, it turns it into something else. So it is not right for religious authorities to concoct doctrine or philosophy, and then regardless of what the actual words of the Bible say, explain that those passages support their doctrine. This is the essence of allegorical teaching and sermonizing, which has been at the heart of synagogue and institutional church liturgy for centuries. Allegory and the reading of a predisposed doctrine back into the Bible is how a religious authority can, for instance, read the Sermon on the Mount of Matthew 5, get to the paragraph about Messiah emphasizing that no one should think that he is what he's saying ought to be taken as meaning that the Torah, the law, the prophets have been abolished or even changed to the slightest degree. And then the authority explains to the congregation that regardless of what the actual words say, we're to understand that Christ did abolish the very things he said that he didn't. And as I said, this is just one example of many. When taken as a package, all this has done considerable harm to Judeo-Christianity. Well, at verse 20, we see that apparently Tamar went to her brother Abishalom's house for refuge. That is, she didn't return to her own living quarters at the virgin's convent or compound, because the reality is she didn't belong there anymore. She had her purity stolen from her. And one can only imagine the malicious gossip that would have erupted if she showed up distraught with torn clothing, soiled with ashes, smeared with blood. Tamar really had no other option than to remain as a ward of her brother, probably for the rest of her or Absalom's life. Now, Absalom counseled her to keep what he views as a family matter to herself, so that there wouldn't be any kind of a public scandal. Well, word of Amnon's incestuous act reached the father, King David, and we're told he became angry. Apparently, that's about as far as the concern went. Just got upset. There's no hint that one word was spoken between David and Amnon. Certainly there's no record that any action whatsoever was taken by David. And you can imagine if there was, we'd have read about it. No rebuke, no punishment, no nothing. So here a serious flaw is exposed in David. David full well knew that by the laws of Moses, Amnon had a price to pay. Justice should be applied. However, one must admit that it's not so cut and dried as to what the price ought to be. The law that comes closest to dealing with this situation is probably Deuteronomy 22, verses 28 and 29. And there it says, if a man comes upon a girl who is a virgin, who is not engaged, and he grabs her and has sexual relations with her, and they're caught in the act, then the man who had intercourse with her must give to the girl's father 1 1/4 pounds of silver shekels, and she'll become his wife, because he humiliated her. He may not divorce her as long as he lives. But the problem is, Tamar was Amnon's half-sister, so marriage was not possible, according to the laws of Leviticus 18:9, which says, you're not to have sexual relations with your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or somewhere else, do not have sexual relations with them. And the idea that Amnon would pay a bit of silver as redemption to his father, King David, well, that's just laughable. Besides, as it says towards the end of Leviticus chapter 18 and verses 29 and 30, for those who engage in any of these disgusting practices, whoever they may be, they are to be cut off from their people. So keep my charge not to follow any of these abominable customs that others before you have followed, and thus defile yourselves by doing them. I'm Adonai, your God. So according to the law of Moses, while Amnon didn't have the death penalty coming, he certainly was to be banished, cut off from his people in the same way a leper might be. And equally, he couldn't marry Tamar as a solution that mainly amounted to a protection for her. So David did nothing. And as what we're about to see, his doing nothing led to even more violence. It's interesting that we see a similar thing happen with David's ancestor, Jacob, who also seemed to have very little interest in disciplining his sons or taking action when wrong was done. Recall that the son of the king of Shechem raped Jacob's daughter, Dinah, and Jacob did essentially nothing except to become angry. In fact, it was the king of Shechem who came to Jacob, hat in hand, to ask Jacob if this could somehow be made right by his son marrying Dinah, which in fact was the remedy of Deuteronomy 22, even though it was going to be some centuries later before the law was even given. Jacob agreed to this, but his sons were so incensed that their father would respond by essentially giving in to a foreign king, they took a violent and wrong action by killing the entire male population of the city, who were innocent. They didn't have any part in this. Jacob's response to this was to move. See, here's another valuable lesson for us all. It is a God principle that wrongdoing, even by our children, must be dealt with. It must be, even harshly, if the situation is serious enough. We can call it discipline if we want to, but God calls it justice. Unfortunately, humanism has taken hold of society in this age. So even a mild slap on the bottom is considered abuse. Can be punished with jail time. Some cases, the state taking the child from the home. Equally so, it has been customary in American society that the mother is the disciplinarian. The father just kind of looks on helplessly, maybe disinterested, prefers to be a buddy more than a parent to his children. Now, while maternal discipline is certainly better than none, it often casts the woman into a role she's not supposed to have to bear, man. It's not their job. It's our job. It's our job to discipline, to exact justice upon our children if it's necessary, especially when they start getting a little bit older. And that's both to benefit them in the long run and to satisfy God's commandments that that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, I can remember several times my mother would say to me, "Boy, wait until your father gets home," and I'd tell him what you did. Oh, man, I did not want to hear that. Those are words no boy, young boy wants to hear. I mean, it was effective. And my father did what was needed when he had to. But apparently David's children didn't have this kind of threat hanging over their heads. And the result, as this and the next few chapters show us, wasn't less violent, more responsible children. Today we're told if we spank our children, we're going to turn them into bullies and car thieves and murderers. But rather, it was David's family produced a stable of reprobate young princes who thought they were all above the law, that there would not be consequences for their behavior. See, ironically, it was the lack of punitive action upon them that led to catastrophic, to deadly results later on in their lives. Oh, what a lesson. Well, after 2 years of a tense rift between Amnon and Tamar's brother, Absalom had neither forgotten nor forgiven. For 2 years, his desolate sister lived with Absalom, a constant reminder of Amnon's arrogant and infamous deed. And no doubt Absalom was sincerely moved by his tormented sister's plight, and it pained him deeply. But at the same time, Absalom knew he could use this to his advantage. to achieve his goal of Israel's throne. And feeling that enough time had passed so that any suspicion could be laid to rest, he found exactly the right circumstance and moment to take action. It was sheep shearing season in Israel. And throughout the Middle East, sheep shearing was a festive, it was a joyful time. When work became mixed with pleasure, it was like a birthday party. Family and friends would gather together to work as a team to shave the wool from the lambs and then exact their profit. But it always involved copious amounts of wine and food. A regular party atmosphere was taking place that folks all look forward to. So Absalom used this innocent occasion to press his father David to come to the family sheep shearing to allow all the male siblings to come as well. Family reunion of sorts, if you would. And naturally, David declined to come himself. This was not the place for a king. And this is what Absalom had counted on. However, he was surprised that his father also declined to allow his many sons to go to this. Now, perhaps it was that David grew a little suspicious when Absalom specifically asked and pressed for Amnon to come along. And Absalom was nothing if not persuasive. And so David set his skepticism aside and he agreed that all the siblings should go, including Amnon. Even if David wasn't suspicious anymore of Absalom's motives, it was always dangerous to have all the king's sons dispatched to one place because of the possibility of some unknown calamity whereby they were all killed, maybe they were captured. Such a thing could bring about the end of a king's dynasty. Well, the place of the gathering was called Baal Hatzor, about 2 miles northwest of Ophrah. This is not the Hatzor, by the way, that's located up in the Galilee region of Israel. Absalom instructed his servants, men who were the most loyal to him, that once they observed Amnon was sufficiently drunk, they were to attack him. They were to kill him. Now, naturally, the servants were kind of reluctant. I mean, the intended victim, after all, was the king's firstborn son. Not a good deal. He was the precious, precious crown prince. But Absalom told him, don't be concerned. He'll take all the blame. Right. So they did the dirty deed, as they were ordered. Now, were the servants right to follow the orders of their master to kill Amnon? No. Now they were responsible for murder before God. They incurred blood guilt. And once again, we see David's past coming back to haunt him. A few years earlier, David had instructed Joab to kill Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, to clear that path so that David could add her to his harem. Other than wanting to be sure that the plan would work and that the Israelite soldiers who would be nearby wouldn't suspect that this was really a murder plot, Joab seemed to be entirely unconcerned about the morality, or rather immorality, and all the wickedness of David's order to him. So, in proportional justice, here we find David's firstborn son is about to be murdered by some disinterested third parties who are just following orders. Well, with Amnon gone, Absalom would be next in the line as king. And David had proved time and time again he wasn't capable of confronting his children's sins. David was never going to exact justice upon Absalom for murder, and everybody knew that. But this was the Middle East, and cultural justice was a complex matter. Absalom didn't hide the fact that indeed he was the head of the conspiracy to kill his half-brother Amnon, and this was because he could then claim the right as the Goel, the family blood avenger. So he felt that the general population would merely see him as doing his family duty and he'd be applauded for it. Well, when David's other sons saw Absalom's men killing Amnon, well, they jumped on their mules and they fled, fearing they were going to be next. Mule, not donkey, is the correct word. In the Hebrew, it is pered. Mules were the mounts that royalty rode because they were expensive. Mules had to be crossbred to produce. It is known that Israel purchased these animals from their neighbors because crossbreeding is forbidden by the Torah. Well, in all this confusion, all this chaos, a rumor spread very quickly that all of David's sons were killed, and the rumor reached David. He thought the worst possible disaster had happened. His sons were all dead, and now his dynasty was done for. And as he lay on the ground in mourning, accompanied by his royal court, Yonadab, David's nephew, speaks up, tells him that the rumor's not true. It's not true. All of David's sons hadn't been killed, just Amnon. Now recall that we saw this same villain, Yonadab, in Amnon's residence. He helped Amnon devise the plot to get Tamar to come to Amnon so he could have her. And of course, we see him now as being near to the king and having his ear. This was a person who was maneuvering to get himself in proper political position to become a man of greater influence in the next administration, and it didn't much matter to him who wore the crown. He was Amnon's ally until Amnon was killed. Now it's time to play it safe and just kind of see how things work themselves out. In fact, Yonadab was so bold as to let David know that as an insider, he knew things that the king didn't know about his own children. He knew the reason for Amnon's assassination, so he didn't want David to think that a full-scale coup was underway. This was just an honor killing. Absalom did it out of proper revenge for his sister Tamar, just as David had facilitated Tamar's rape by ordering her to go to Amnon to fix him some food. Now David has facilitated his firstborn son's death by ordering Amnon and all of his sons to attend that sheep shearing. Notice the pattern. First, unlawful sex, and then murder. The irony gets even thicker. Jonadab says, "Oh, my lord, the king shouldn't take it all that seriously, as if all the king's sons are dead. It's only Amnon." See, this has the same kind of sociopathic and indifferent tone of, don't let this matter get you down, the sword devours in one way or another. Those are the words that David said to Joab when told that several innocent Hebrew soldiers had died in order for Uriah to be killed without any suspicion being placed upon the king. David would have instantly recognized that once again, the divine curse for his adultery and murder had fallen upon him like a guillotine. Those words of dark promise from God, "The sword shall never leave your household." These lay upon David like was a boulder on his chest. He was trapped. He could hardly breathe. Absalom knew he would need to stay far away from his father for a while. Murdering the crown prince was far more serious than rape. Not only that, but Amnon's side of the family would now be after blood revenge on the blood avenger. That's kind of the ways of the Orientals. So he went to his mother's hometown, and he stayed under the protection of his grandfather, the king of Geshur. He was kind of biding his time. And many months passed. And David, finally coming to terms with the death of his son Amnon, began to set his mind on Absalom. Now, to say David was conflicted probably puts it mildly. I mean, since his firstborn was killed, who was going to be next in line to replace him? Just as Amnon had been seen as the crown prince, Absalom must have been seen as the next one after him by everybody. Can David bring him back and forgive him? Can David bring him back and trust him not to do to David what he did to Amnon? David well understood the ways of blood revenge, but he also well understood that Absalom, his son, was ambitious, and he was ruthless, and he was an impatient man. Well, let's move on to 2 Samuel chapter 14. 2 Samuel chapter 14, page 348 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king missed Absalom, so Joab sent to Tekoa, brought from there a clever woman, and said to her, "Please, pretend you're a mourner. Put on mourning clothes and don't anoint yourself with oil, but appear to be a woman who has mourned for the dead for a long time. Go in to the king and speak to him in this fashion." And then Joab told her just what to say. And when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell down with her face to the ground, prostrating herself, and said, "King, help!" The king said to her, "What's the trouble?" And she answered, "I'm a widow. And after my husband died, my two sons were out in the field, and they got into a fight with each other, and there was no one to separate them, and one hit the other and killed him. Now the whole family has come against me, your servant. They're saying, 'Hand over the one who hit his brother, so that he can put him to death for killing his brother.' They want to destroy the heir as well, and thus quench my one remaining coal. Then my husband will have neither name nor survivor anywhere on earth." And the king said to the woman, "Go back home. I myself will decide what to do about you." The woman of Tekoa said to the king, "My lord king, let the guilt be on me and my father's family. The king and his throne be guiltless." The king answered, "If anyone says anything to you, you bring him to me. He won't bother you anymore." "Please," she said, "let the king swear by Adonai, your God, that the blood avengers won't do any more destroying, so they won't destroy my son." And he said, "As Adonai lives, not one of your son's hairs will fall to the ground." Then the woman said, "Please, allow your servant to say something else to my lord the king." "Go on," he replied. The woman said, "Why is it then that you have produced a situation exactly like this against God's people? By saying what you have said, the king has virtually incriminated himself, in that the king does not bring home again the son he has banished. For we will all die someday. We'll all be like water spilled on the ground that can't be gathered up again. And God makes no exception for anyone. The king should think of some way to keep the son he banished from being forever an outcast. Now the reason I came to speak to you about this matter to my lord the king is that the people were intimidating me. So your servant said, 'I will speak now to the king. Maybe the king will do what his servant is asking. For the king will listen and rescue his servant from the hands of those who would destroy me and my son together from our share of God's inheritance.' Then your servant said, 'Please let my lord the king say something that will give me relief. For my lord the king is like an angel of God in discerning good from bad. And may Adonai your God be with you.' Then the king answered the woman, 'I'm going to ask you a question, and please don't hide anything from me.' The woman said, 'Let my lord the king now speak.' The king asked, 'Did Joab put you up to this?' The woman answered, 'As you live, my lord the king, when the lord king speaks, no one can avoid the issues by turning either to the right or the left. Yes, it was your servant Joab who had me do this, and he put in my mouth every word you heard your servant say. Your servant Joab did this in order to bring about some change in the situation, but my lord is wise. He has the wisdom of an angel of God when it comes to understanding anything that goes on in the land.' And the king said to Joab, 'All right, I'm granting this request. Go bring back young Absalom.' And Joab fell to the ground on his face, prostrating himself, and blessed the king. And Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I have won your favor, my lord king, because the king has done what your servant requested.' Then Yoav got up, went to Geshur, and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. However, the king said, let him return to his own house. He's not to appear in my presence. So Absalom returned to his own house and did not appear before the king. Now in all Israel, there was no one more praised for his beauty than Absalom. There was no defect on him from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He'd cut his hair only once a year at the end of the year. And the only reason he cut it was because it weighed him down. He weighed the hair from his head at 200 shekels using the royal weight, about 5 pounds. To Absalom were born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. Absalom lived 2 years in Jerusalem without appearing before the king, and then Absalom summoned Joab, planning to send him to the king, but he refused to come to him, and he summoned him a second time. He still wouldn't come. So he said to his servant, see, Joab's field is close to mine, and he has barley there. Go, set it on fire. Absalom's servant set the field on fire, and then Joab got up and went to Absalom at his house and asked him, why did your servant set my field on fire? And Absalom answered Yoav and said, look, I sent a message for you to come here so that I could send you to the king to ask, why did I come from Geshur? It had been better for me if I stayed there. So now let me appear before the king. And if I'm guilty of anything, he can kill me. Yoav went to the king and told him. And when he had called for Absalom, he went to the king and prostrated himself with his face to the ground before the king. Then the king kissed Absalom. In verse 1, the palace intrigue is all too apparent again. Yoav, another of David's nephews and his chief military commander, re-enters the scene. And he determines to try and effect reconciliation between David and Absalom. But to what end? Why? See, it's difficult from the context to figure out if Yoav's just being a good, loyal servant to David, and with empathy, he sees that the king longs for his son Absalom, but is morally paralyzed, and he can't figure out how to deal with the conundrum of wanting to see the prodigal son who had just killed the other son. Or maybe was it that Joab was secretly loyal to Absalom and is trying to get him back to Jerusalem and nearer to the throne to prepare for that day that David would have to turn power over to his successor? Now, we can't know for sure. The population of Israel was, however, probably behind Absalom, now that Amnon was dead. They well knew what Amnon had done to Tamar, and likely they kind of admired Absalom for doing his duty as a blood avenger. But of course, the laws of Moses don't allow this kind of a thing. Amnon had robbed Tamar of her virginity, but he'd committed no capital crime. So while avenging Tamar's rape was kind of culturally expected, it was evil in God's eyes. It was wrong in the law of Moses. But the nature of populist sentiment always has to do with political correctness and the current national mood. Only rarely does divine and eternal right and wrong play any role. But it is the tendency of both Jew and Christian to freely kind of substitute one for the other, I think. Now, I'd like to conclude today's lesson with this thought. In our time, we have seen an assault upon God's holiness, upon his laws and commandments, and his authority, as perhaps never before. Man-made doctrines and philosophies and intellectualism rules the day. The issues of homosexual rights, gay marriage, disposition of the Holy Land of Israel, abortion, Islam is a good and right religion, and so much more, are today viewed through the eyes of 21st century modernity that stresses tolerance, above all else, rather than to see things through the eyes of the Creator who stresses obedience. And sadly, vast segments of the church and the synagogue are fully caught up in this spider's web of deceit and rebellion that makes looking towards our unstable hearts as the best judge of good and evil rather than following God's written commandments. You know, it's not difficult to see the striking parallels between what's happening in David's Israel of 980 BC and the worldwide march towards secularism in our day. Very similar. And at the core of the issue, then as now, is the relegating of the Torah and God's Word to irrelevance in favor of the philosophies of religious intellectuals and institutions. The hope that we have is that a global grassroots revival is underway that wants to restore the entire Word of God to its rightful place of authority. And central to that is the rediscovery of the validity and the value of the Torah and the Old Testament. A sizable segment of Christianity has declared that God has essentially become reduced to one attribute, love. His other attributes, the much more difficult and demanding ones, it seems were severed from him when we turn the page of our Bible to the book of Matthew. And love demands that people of the same sex who love each other be allowed to marry. Love demands that Gentile foreigners and those who hate God's people receive their fair share of Abraham's inheritance, Israel, because that'll bring peace. Love demands that Allah be given equal status with Jehovah, because it makes no difference who we view as God as long as we all have faith in a higher being, any higher being. Love says we cannot tell a pregnant woman whether or not she can kill the baby that's in her womb, because that removes her choice. Love prohibits taking the life of a murderer, and it overrides every divine commandment that demands proportionate justice, especially if it's not in line with our thinking, because that's retribution. And retribution ought to be beneath us by now. Love demands that our concerns and dreams must be God's chief concern, because he's here to make us rich and happy. See, a sizable segment of Judaism has declared that God's main attribute is humanitarianism. And humanitarianism demands that God's enemies be treated as God's friends. Humanitarianism demands that God's people must no longer see themselves as the distinct and set apart people that he made them to be. Humanitarianism says that if Jews are just nice enough to the people who hate them, then those people will see the inherent human goodness of the Jewish people and accept them. Humanitarianism says that our behavior is what gives us righteousness before the Lord. Humanitarianism is the means that God ordained to bring about the conditions that will bring in the Messiah and his kingdom. And none of the philosophies and doctrines that I've just listed, which are just but a few of many, has any scriptural basis. None of it reflects any divine reality. But it does reflect a steady falling away from God, even by those who insist that they love and want to serve him. Just as it was with David, just as it was with Israel at the time of the kings. We're going to continue this next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.